folks, welcome to another exciting episode of Long Shots. Sharad, did you notice I used the word exciting after quite some time? I actually dropped it because of your incessant complaints about me lacking sufficient adjectives to describe my feeling.
Or maybe you're actually excited today after a really long time.
No, I don't think so, man. That's kind of downplaying the entire thing that we do. You know, I'm excited all the time. I'm just not saying it now. So we have with us Mr. Vivek Mashani. Hey, Vivek, how's it going, man?
Yeah, all good. It's fantastic and excited again at my end as well.
Vivek chooses to just borrow my adjective.
Excitement has been copyrighted.
Yeah. No, but it's very good to have you remotely. Like the norm has been for our podcast now.
Yeah.
It's again been some time since we have all been in a single room, but that's the new era, I would say. We are almost at the end of 2020.
Yeah.
And nevertheless, it's great that Vivek, you could find some time to plug in. And Vivek, obviously, I can describe him as a value investing proponent.
Okay.
As a financial freedom proponent. He is. He has around 35,000-40,000 odd followers on Twitter. He's actively writing about it all the time. So Vivek, value investing as a philosophy, as a mission, has been facing a fair amount of brickbats in the last, I would say, 12 months. For me, that actually hit when Ashwath Damodaran wrote a 3-part blog against value investing.
And sort of peeling the onion on what exactly it means. So, would love to hear your thoughts because you're a flag bearer.
For has your proponents become harder proposition in the last few months?
Yeah, so it's I think value investing is a key word. It's like broad based, and within value investing itself, there are many ideologies. You know, there are people who are Graham follower who looks for like cheap stocks, and then you have typical Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger follower who is more proponent of a growth kind of investing. And, it's like a big, big ocean, So I would say some pockets of value investing is not working in this era. But yeah, pretty much everything else where you can make money by investing at a slightly discounted or margin of safety, I think it's value investing. So,
but do you have any?
It's still there, I would say. It's not totally gone.
Amongst the, one of the key messages I kind of derived from Professor Damodaran's blog was that how over time value investing has kind of taken almost a, I would say, cultish, preachy kind of a, subtext, which I think is both true and false. Depends on how, in-depth you are in terms of, following that philosophy. And how educated one is, because there's obviously a kind of risk with value investing where the big success stories are often cited as a validation for the incorporation of those methods without actually taking into account that there was a context, there was a time, and it's just not the headline point of view that someone puts out. There's also a lot of detail that goes in it. So Within value investing, how do you see it? Like, how would you describe it? I mean, you yourself mentioned that there are so many different schools of thought. Some are working, some are not working. I'm assuming that you are talking about the ones which work still. Which are those layers?
So I think the world has changed and it has moved into a different direction. Earlier the market were not that efficient and the information availability was not that great. And people, even though, they get the information, they could materialize that and find something very cheap. Now, today, today's time and age, we all know, you are on Twitter and other social media network. It takes like fractions of seconds to the news actually to go out. And it's very difficult to get that kind of arbitrage where you get something worth of 1 rupee for 50 paisa, right? That typical Graham style of investing. So I think that kind of value investing is dead. For now, and again, when there is a deep recession and all that, it can come back, there is no doubt about it. Other way the world is moving is more on the, giant platform kind of businesses like Google and Amazon and those kind of businesses. And there, it looks like you need a growth mindset, a mindset like a PE investor. So that way, the overall world has changed in a different direction, and that is the reason probably some ideology is not working. What I follow personally is more of a blending of technicals and some price volume action to take initial screening decisions and then come out with a growth value investing kind of framework where I look for compounding companies which can grow for a prolonged period of time. So that is the kind of principle or ideology I am following, and again it's not like a textbook kind of ideology because it's more my research on the top of different things which I've learned over a period of time from different people.
Yeah, no, that's fair, and central to value investing has always been fundamental valuation or doing a bottom-up fundamental valuation of companies. And during COVID and what has happened in the last few months, we have seen a rapid growth in certain sectors, right? Be it big tech, especially big tech. And the entire market that has seen an upswing has been, last few months or even a year has been driven by so-called the FANG stocks, right? And when you put a value hat on it, it's very hard to sort of, in hindsight, yes, you can see it, but it's very hard to sort of justify those stocks on a value frame of mind. But having said that, missing the bus on those names is leaving significant money on the table, right? How does one sort of merge valuation from a value investing school of thought, but at the same time keep these things in mind where, if you want growth, you got to pay up, right? That whole margin of safety and fundamental valuation also has to be, there is a lot of qualitative assessment that comes with it. How does one think about that? And, you're an investor yourself, it's obviously a debate that keeps on going, but how does one think about marrying these two things? You also use the word technical analysis with fundamental. How do you sort of go about mixing those two up?
Sure. So I'll first of all take your first part in terms of thinking about valuation. And, I would like to quote a recent thought from Mr. Manish Chokhani, who spoke in the Value Investing Pioneer Summit in recently. It was an online event by CFA Society. And two things he mentioned about how it is, the world is getting difficult, right? So one, you have the central banks keeping interest rate artificially very low. It's almost zero across the bigger nations like developed countries. And always you have this correlation between price to earnings ratio and an interest rate, right? There is an inverse correlation. So if the interest rates go high, you will basically ask for a lower PE because, your cost of capital goes high. And if your interest almost goes zero, almost it's a free money, you are fine with even 4-5% return, and hence you will be willing to pay even higher PE ratio, right? So that is one part. When front-ended, the valuation which we give or people tend to give goes crazily high, and by traditional Graham style of value investing, you will feel like it's a crazy kind of value and you don't have that margin of safety. Other hand, the world is getting disrupted so fast, right? Mm-hmm. And across, you are seeing that companies are increasingly getting shut down very quickly, right? So the death rate of the companies has become very quick. Mm-hmm. So then the question around terminal value, of which we discuss in DCF and all that, yeah, goes for a toss. So one hand, you have front-loaded higher PE, and other hand, you have high risk of terminal value itself getting to zero. So that is the reason, it's very difficult. And the way I see this is, as you rightly said, that how the shift is occurring into these top FANG stocks and the companies which are probably more like a platform businesses and going in a big way. So as an investor, we should look for big mega trends. And if we are able to find those big mega trends and we are able to ride it for a long, long period of time, that is where I think we can create a huge wealth in investing. And that's what we again saw in India as well. 2000 to 2010, we had real estate boom and a lot of real estate and infra companies did well. 2010 to 20, if you see the financials and chemical stocks and pharma stocks did well, auto ancillary did well. So if we are able to find those kind of mega trends, I think that's where generate alpha and compound our money over a long period of time. So rather than thinking too much into valuation,
yeah,
the this is probably the way to go about.
I mean, it's kind of fascinating because, I mean, looking at things more from a sectoral perspective in terms of where tailwinds are coming or where headwinds are coming and be safe from that end of the spectrum. I mean, it's kind of closely also linked to, you know, obviously there's an underlying theme within the market around a particular story. But that kind of is also closely plugged with what is the mood and the momentum which kind of, you know, comes along with it.
Yes.
Right? And these disruption cycles, they have an entry point. They also have an exit point, to be fair. I mean, they never last forever.
Yes.
Right? It that kind of is paradoxically kind of against that, you know, I would say that buy and hold thesis, no? Because often, like if you have like a 5-6 year cycle or a 7 or 8 year cycle where, say, you know, you're looking at financials or you're looking at fintech, I mean, in the listed space, maybe not in India that much, but, you know, globally, like in India, we're looking at right now pharma. I mean, these cycles also kind of have a start and an end point, right? And one thing that often is not talked about a lot in value investing is what's the selling discipline, right? I mean, that's usually not looked at. Whereas if you're looking at sectoral trends, selling discipline becomes a fairly central aspect, no? How do you square that?
Yeah. So I think you are very right in terming that cycles and you know the kind of tailwinds and headwinds that comes into the sector. And if you think about a greater world and economies as such and businesses as such, you know, each and every economy is cyclical, right? So be it US or India or any economy in the world is cyclical. Any business in the world is cyclical, right? So the only difference is, you know, the cycles are probably very big. Like it could be 10-15 year cycle, it could be 5-7 year cycle, or it could be very short cycle, which is like 2-3 years kind of cycle. And typically in the investing world, when the cycle is small, we tell them as a commodity or cyclical stocks. And when you know the cycles are big, we say that it's a structural mega trend and buy and hold kind of story. But we ultimately forget that, no, ultimately everything slows down, right? There is nothing sacrosanct in the world which will keep growing for infinite period of time. And we have seen that, right? So we have seen infra, it grew for many, many years and then suddenly it dipped. Auto people were thinking it's a long cycle and there is always demand deficit and, you know, lot of demand there in the market and people still don't have a two-wheeler and four-wheeler in our country. And if you see last 2 years, it was like a huge slowdown, right? Almost after 8-9 years of cycle, it went into slowdown. So I think, as you rightly said, we need some exit strategy. So it could be based upon the underlying sector. If it is a highly cyclical and short-term cycle, then you should know that we need to exit in near term. And if it is a longer cycle, still we need to have exit strategies in place. And that is the reason, you know, I like to blend technical analysis with overall fundamental studies in my research. And I have a lot of indicators which I use to exit my positions along with some of the KPIs in fundamentals which formed my investment thesis in the initial stage itself. So that way, you know, I look at from the both the complementary power from technicals and fundamentals. And for longer cycles, it could be like monthly charts where, you know, I can see like big cycles and from shorter cycles, it could be like weekly charts and you know, that will give me a finer, smaller time frame exits. So that is how I look and practice this entire.
You know, like value investing in the Western world, right? I mean, when it's sort of back in the days, I'm talking about 40s and, you know, when first works of Charlie Munger and all, people were talking about value investing and these models were coming into place. And a lot of people viewed equities, you know, they used methods of how they valued bonds. Like instead of coupon, they used dividends as a proxy and came dividend discount model. And then over time, we have evolved. The reason sort of I'm getting to is, you know, value investing seems a little different in the West than it seems in India. And the reason being sort of multiple things, right? A, quality of disclosure becomes a big factor in determining the fund, you know, assessing the fundamental value. But also the way the information travels, right? Like now you rightly pointed out, like everything is so quick, right? there is hardly any time of information asymmetries diminishing quickly. But fundamentally, from a regulation and from a corporate governance and from disclosure quality, do you think value investing is a much more difficult task in the Indian ecosystem as things stand? Because, you know, we're not remotely as evolved as the Western world. Or do you think, you know, value investing is a long-term game? You should be able to find those pockets of margins of safety.
See, again, my thoughts will go in the same direction, that we cannot term everything under value investing in the same framework. So what probably you are talking about is one component or one ideology of value investing, which is more like a dividend, high dividend yield stock investing, where if you see high dividend yields and you see that, you know, the companies are still having good earnings yield, we tend to, you know, invest in these companies. So it's working fine in developed countries, and there is reason for that, that the entire market is saturated, right? So if in a zero interest rate scenario and 2%, 3% GDP growth rate scenario, if you are getting like 4-5% dividend yield, it's probably a good thing to be in a place where you have good margin of safety and visibility of cash flow just through dividends. But, you know, in Indian context, it's again my personal view and no recommendation as such. But in Indian view, you know, when you see such companies with a very high dividend yield, that is probably a value trap, because either they are not able to grow or the market doesn't see a long runway for these kind of companies.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there could be really bad corporate governance and issues within the company, which probably as an outsider, we don't see, but a lot of smart people out there know that there is an issue in these companies, right? And classic examples you can see, like, say, Coal India, right? So, Coal India is like trading at like 5 to 7% dividend yield. But one, we know that probably, you know, that entire field or sector is going to go away, because we might not probably use coal in like 5-7 years after.
Yeah.
Same way, if you think about earlier ONGC, which was trading at very high dividend yield, and it was a cash rich company, and people thought it's a great value, and you look back now, you know, they merged with a debt ridden company, and you know, now that is no more a cash rich company, right? So the people probably were skeptical that, you know, government can do something around these kind of companies, and they can suck out the dividend, and they can penalize that these companies just to take out cash and all that, right? So in India or developed country, I feel personally that in the bull run, particularly if you are getting too high dividend yield kind of companies, we should be skeptical and probably research it much more in depth, you know, and see whether the growth triggers are missing, or corporate governance is an issue, or it's a dying industry.
But I think, you know, like the very interesting point on value trap, as a, like dividend yield being a potential value trap. And I think there's a theme there in India as well, right? In terms of, like, I mean, it's much more prominent within PSU stocks. I mean, the kind of examples that you were also sharing, the kind of, I mean, if you also look at like REC, you know, that also is a high yielding stock. Effectively, isn't it probably better to look at these opportunities, say in PS, because I mean, there's always that entire default risk, you know, or bailout risk in India. And a lot of times sovereigns are or sovereign backed companies, you know, they kind of are just considered to be safer bets, right? To kind of lock your savings. I mean, I'm talking at a very strictly retail investor level. I'm not talking, you know, if one is like a big fund manager and one is looking at, you know, capital appreciation in a long-term basis. But I mean, effectively, there's a reason why every Indian will probably have every second Indian will probably have a State Bank of India bank account, you know, because there is low amount of quote unquote default risk, or, you know, high amount of high probability of a bailout event happening. So is it probably better to look at such kind of PSU opportunities more as a debt like instrument? I mean, equity behaving like debt. Is there merit to that perspective, you think?
So if we think of a math, right, I'm not even talking about companies and sectors here, but if we think about math, say for example, we buy a company at 100 rupees and it's quoting at 8% dividend yield, right, and we are getting 8 rupees as dividend, and just because that growth is missing and there is issue in terms of corporate governance or any other reason, you know, and then the stock price keeps coming down, and over a period of time, probably it comes to 50. And, you know, we still are probably, luckily, if we are getting still 8 rupees as a dividend, we feel like we are getting a 16% yield, right? But if you think about the overall returns, we have lost almost like 50% already in the capital.
But you know, there are all, there are also instances where, sorry to kind of, you know, interject, but there are also like instances and examples where it doesn't go from 100 to 50, but it stays range bound for a long period of time. Right. I mean, and it's kind of cyclical. I mean, I'm kind of like, not obviously kind of giving any recommendations here, but if you look at like, you know, PFC or REC, like power cyclical stocks, you can kind of see that, that in that, I mean, they kind of are behaving like pseudo lenders, right? Effectively, they're lenders to DISCOMs. So they kind of follow that lending cycle, which is kind of locked closely with the demand cycle at the consumer end. And obviously on the demand cycle at the consumer end, there are price caps. So there is naturally, they will never go skyrocketingly high, but they always, you know, kind of end up giving you like a 7 to 10% yield, right? Specifically for those opportunities where there is not that much capital erosion. I mean, there won't be capital appreciation, but there's not that much capital erosion as well. In those instances, I mean, that's where my thought was coming from.
Yeah, sure, but I totally get your point, and those kind of things happen, and sometimes even, you know, we may get lucky and it can go up also.
Yeah.
But the idea here is, if we are taking an equity risk, right? So the underlying is equity, and that means we are taking a higher risk than any fixed income instrument, which is probably of a similar rating. As an investor, we should command higher return, right? So our return expectation should go higher. Or else, you know, why not to just put money in the government bond itself? I think it's quoting around 7 to 5% yield. So why not just a highest safety asset class where you don't need to worry about anything, and you get assured returns for incremental 1 or 2% yield? Why to take that incremental equity risk? And again, the question comes, if we are taking equity risk, and you know, if we want to have that slightly higher risk, why to go into safe haven, and why to not experiment into some of the growth companies? And
sure,
again, totally agree that companies may default and, you know, it can go to zero. We had cases of Yes Bank, DHFL, a lot of such companies. So there, two things will protect us. One is portfolio allocation, where we can diversify, and, you know, even if one company in the portfolio go bust, we are still protected. And second is, you know, probably I would say we should look for debt-free companies. So the probabilities of default and going it to zero probably goes down significantly.
So that's fair. And, you know, I also wanted to get a sense of, you know, you have your own website as well, and, you know, talk a fair bit about financial freedom as well. You know, what kind of content on your website does, you know, get most traction? And I ask because you get a sense of the appetite of what kind of investment pieces that people try to listen to or read, and gives you good read-throughs as well. And this is a time when we've seen retail investors really step up, right, during the COVID whole time frame in the last 5-6 months, give or take. Like, we've seen a lot of retail investment money come into the market. So what kind of content do you think generally is flying well these days?
Yeah, so what I tend to put is, I'm not a believer of directly giving stock tip or stock recommendation.
Sure.
I generally don't do that. And my idea is just to broaden the horizon of people in terms of thought process, how they should think of businesses, how they should think of investing, and how they should think of their own personal finance. And there, that's where, you know, in the overall financial freedom ambit, I give the context of how you can save first and, expense later, and how you can compound your money, and how you can think about the overall compounding machine. And I also talk about how as a person you can compound yourself and keep investing in yourself and grow, your skills, and that ways, you know, you can grow your capital. So those are the kind of, pieces or content I generally like to share. And I think, obviously, there is a niche kind of people who would like to read that, because a lot of people are just wanting some stock tip and easy shortcuts, which generally don't end up well.
Yeah.
But overall, I've got really good feedback, and in terms of what they learn is more around discipline and the entire process rather than shortcuts to investing.
Yeah, and that's in line with the larger value investing theme, right? I mean, being disciplined about it. I mean, that's one thing that's aggressively pushed in that school of thought. You know, also like in the last few months, because of higher retail participation, there's a new wave of retail investors who are also sort of looking at the US equity markets, who feel like it's a good idea, who get swayed and by the performances of the Alphabets and Googles and Apples of the world. Do you have a view on that? I mean, not from a stock picking standpoint, but thematically, the idea of someone who's earning or saving in Indian rupees at a retail level, of course, and deploying that capital in Western securities. It's a trend that's gaining some traction in India. Do you have any thoughts on that as well? And, you know, how do you feel about that?
So I think, you know, in terms of the advice kind of thing, you know, they should definitely take advice from financial advisors, because definitely, you know, you have these things moving in the market, and there are always periods of momentum where things looks very crazy. Earlier it was Bitcoin, and you know, now different things are coming up. But as a if I talk about personal view, I like kind of these businesses are, and these are mostly platform businesses out there, you know, the Google and Amazons of the world. And I personally, you know, think that they will take substantial growth from other companies and particularly from the offline world. And they are probably the new normal. You know, the first wave was agri wave, which we saw. Mm-hmm. You know, then we saw the industrial age. Then we saw the rise of service sectors. And then, you know, probably it's the rise of platform businesses. And I also, same, you know, Manish Chokhani's interview, probably he also mentions the same thing, you know, that these are the kind of future businesses they are, which are taking up substantial market share. Mm-hmm. So yeah, as a businesses, I'm pretty positive about how they are doing and how they are growing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's not that plain vanilla that, you know, since it is growing, just put into any company and just sit there, right? So it's more, it requires more deeper research. And as a retail investor, if somebody is thinking about it, they should definitely, you know, consult their financial advisor and ask their opinion. Mm-hmm.
No, sure, that makes sense. And just sticking to these US stocks, right? Just out of curiosity, how do you justify these from a valuation standpoint in a value investing framework? And like you rightly said, you know, value investing is so wide and broad. There's so many different levels to it. I mean, you can make an argument that they're sort of nearing monopolistic level of power, market power. So that typically bodes well for value investors. But from a, you know, valuation standpoint, like how do you look at something like this? Because this is not something that, you know, is much talked about when, you know, it's sort of like growth in a way, right?
Yeah. So, you know, again, my thoughts are it's very difficult, as you rightly said, and I would rather quote an example, right? So, there was a piece written by Ashwath Damodaran, who is like almost god of valuation in the academic field, and he tried to value you know, Uber in his blog, and he had, I think, if I remember correctly, he had pointed out 5.6 billion USD or something kind of valuation. And fast forward 2 years now, two or 2.5 years now, I think Uber is quoting at somewhere around 18 billion kind of market cap, right?
Yeah.
So one, you know, by the traditional methods of valuation, where we think about market share and the market size, right? That totally goes for a toss when we are valuing these kind of businesses. One, because the scale at which it can grow is something very unimaginable, because it's like a winner takes it all kind of you know, businesses, right? Where if some business can grow, it will grow exponentially, and if they die, they will not go anywhere. Second is the market itself expands, right? So that is another point where our traditional DCF, where we think about this is the market size and this is the market share and this is how the growth looks like, that also goes for a toss. And third is, you know, in terms of the longevity, right? Because as I said, not all businesses will grow for a long period of time. because one winner will take all the market share and probably rest of them will die or will not grow at all.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult, I would say, and the traditional tools will not work. It's again, I think we have to be more subjective in terms of understanding the finer quality traits rather than going into numerical things when we are looking at these businesses. That's my personal opinion.
I mean, it's also like you were saying that the market expands. So, I mean, eventually most of these platform or aggregation plays, they kind of become like a addition of many micro monopolies, right? And I mean, even when you're forecasting, I mean, like if you look at it like a very pure bottom-up kind of a perspective that you're trying to like do some sort of a free cash flow forecast for them. I mean, it becomes incredibly difficult to predict what the next micro monopoly might be. I mean, you can probably forecast the growth within an existing monopoly. Even like when you look at Uber, I mean, Uber like started with that taxi aggregation. They're now getting into everything from financial services to, you know, deliveries. In deliveries also, they are kind of, you know, absorbing different verticals. Each has its own growth narrative. So I guess that's kind of, you know, one thing that probably makes it extremely challenging to do like a bottom-up analysis, and probably best to look at these more top-down based on price action and, you know, comparable type of a view in terms of assessing how expensive or cheap they are. And, you know, secondly, you know, when you kind of spoke of Damodaran, I think he also kind of, if I recall correctly, he was also making a point that how in these platform plays, you know, just the fact that if you look at R&D, right, how do you look at R&D from on a cash basis? Or do you even look at it on a cash basis, or do you look at it as a capitalized asset and actually don't assume upfront cash impacts, which kind of depresses the free cash flow profile? I guess accounting norms are also, and you know, the way we look at expected cash flow generation, that also needs a revise. That also needs a review, yeah. Right? Considering how these businesses operate.
Absolutely. And what you talk about, I read recently a book on platform businesses, and they talked about the concept of layering, right? So you have, take an example of LinkedIn itself, right? So it started with professionals connecting with professionals, and it was more like a social media of professional kind of earlier version. And then they, on the top of it, added a functionality where you can create a blog, right? So now you have creators of content, and then you have professionals. So it's one layer added to it, and the beauty about these kind of layers is, you know, you have the same user base, like the professionals, out of whom, you know, 10% could become creators and start writing a blog, and then you have 90% of people who are users. And again, a user can also be a creator for other subjects. So say, for example, I write on finance, and I could be reader of a blog of Sharath, who is probably, you know, writing on creativity, right? So that is the beauty about these businesses. And with a very small incremental, you know, almost zero fixed cost, incremental cost, you can create a new vertical in itself and create a new leg of growth. And same way, you know, they opened it up for recruiters, and you know, you had already HR professionals on the platform, and they posted JDs, and some of the users who were interested, they went to consume the you know, the JDs of the HR professional. And same way, they added the core structure, and
yeah,
they added the learning content, and some creators would create the courses and others are consuming the courses. So within the same platform, you can basically add a lot of layers of growth without much of incremental cost, and that's why it probably gets too difficult to value them.
And I guess that's also, I mean, kind of just a kind of I would say thought, that's probably a reason why they attract so much private capital in a very lumpy, front-loaded manner, right? Because I mean, private capital is probably more suited to even assess such kind of opportunities. And I mean, eventually, they eventually list when there is some amount of stability and when, you know, regular participants in the market can actually take a call on it. Like, I can't even imagine, like, for, you know, during LinkedIn is obviously not, it's not yet listed, right? But like, let's look at Facebook, right? I mean, in case of Facebook, I mean, I can't even imagine in those early days, how do you value a business like Facebook? Because it's basically just a kind of a network, which is, you know, organically growing, and there are so many endless opportunities of cross-selling. Eventually, when it became like a clear-cut ad sales model, that's when it got listed. Till that time, it attracted fair amount of private capital. So maybe, I mean, that's the reason why platform businesses are more suitable for, you know, sophisticated institutional capital in the initial cycle, right? Before they actually hit the market.
Yeah, that's totally true. And that's why, you know, traditionally, as you rightly said, you know, a lot of PE investors take interest in these businesses, and hardly you would see any practicing investors putting money. Another thing is, you know, they also know the risk that, you know, out of 100 businesses, probably 2-3 will become Facebook, and there is always a survivorship bias, and not everyone will grow and get big. So a lot of them will die, and that doesn't go well with the investing mindset, where we are not used to, or we don't have that appetite to see businesses dying very frequently, right? And valuation is other game which you mentioned. So yeah, it's true. I think it's more PE kind. Even if something is listed in the space, you know, we have to look at in a similar way, that we cannot have 20% of one company in the portfolio and think that, you know, it will make money for us, because there is high probability of death even if they grow big. You know?
Yeah.
So
it's
our proposition.
Yeah, no, in VC, right, one of the first things that you sort of learn is the M&M test, how good is the management and how big is the market, right? And I think in public companies as well, there's a lot of faith being put on management, or the, you know, saying that, you know what, they'll deliver it. And I can see that, like, you know, look at companies like Netflix, Uber, or, you know, or even Tesla. I mean, none of them generate free cash flow. I mean, that's sort of the benchmark of valuation from an old school perspective, right? I mean, if there's no free cash flow, how do you even begin to value a company? But there is that hope, there is that element of conviction that, you know what, the management is strong, the market is big enough, they will figure out a way to monetize. I mean, we've dealt with this in so many different avenues, right? I mean, they're not making money, but you just sort of assume that, you know what, the management is strong enough, the market is big enough, there will be a time that they will make money. And that mindset has increasingly now come into the public market space, right? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I would say in pockets, yes. And again, you know, it depends upon which kind of businesses which we are looking in the listed space. Some of them have started coming, and it is, again, I would say, phases. You know, sometimes these bubbles burst, and sometimes it goes longer. But, you know, we cannot look each and every company, even if it is a platform business, from the same lens.
Yeah,
there are different characteristics, different market sizes, and different way to look at it, right? So, say, for example, you are looking Uber versus Matrimony, right? We cannot give same probably multiple to both, because here in Matrimony, probably even if you have a large customer base, the touch point is always once in a life, right? Because you probably just get married once, and you need, the transaction is over, and probably you'll never come back to the platform, right?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, probably Uber, like, platform, we might use it daily if we are commuting.
Twice or thrice daily, I guess, right? Yeah.
Yeah, twice or thrice also sometimes. So that way, you know, sometimes in the phases of euphoria, market gets irrational and tends to paint each and every company with the same brush. But, you know, there are a lot of finer aspects to it when we look at these companies.
So, like, let's kind of, you know, head back to India. I mean, obviously, you know, if you look at the markets here, I mean, I talk to any Western fund manager and about Indian markets, generally the first view is, and Sharat, I think you kind of, you pretty much shared that during your experience in Canada as well, that, oh, Indian markets are too expensive. You know, I mean, even right now, if you look at Nifty PE, it's like, I think 34 times, it has exceeded pre-COVID levels. Obviously, there's a big growth narrative here, pretty much about everything, right? Within the growth narrative, from a company by company perspective, one does realize that, yeah, India might have a 300 million strong middle class, but then how many people actually have the appetite to pay? That pool is obviously much smaller than the 300 million. But effectively, I mean, when you're looking at Indian stocks on average, I mean, they do have a kind of a overhanging growth narrative because of the lack of penetration in many sectors here, right? And that's why I think every portfolio manager would probably have a few common names, right? I mean, it's kind of everybody is going to like have those 7, 8, 10 names in their mix, and then they kind of obviously go into other, you know, small caps or mid caps and kind of form a diversified or concentrated profile. And I've heard a lot of the people from the investing world actually say that, look, here it's very price action oriented, so don't bring your value arsenal. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with that, but I mean, you hear that often, that it's pretty much price action oriented. Don't bring your value arsenal. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you have a few good quality names, theek hai, and baki it's kind of more an action, more a question of when you go in and when you go out. Do you buy that kind of a thesis? Do you think there's some merit into it? Because a lot of people say that.
So, see, again, I would like to quote data or facts here. So, I had a chance to see this video on megatrends and growth by, I think it was by Utpal Sheth on, again, CFA Society India. So he quoted a beautiful thing, you know, that if we think about the last few decades, you know, there are only probably 175 companies who has been able to cross PBT of, say, I think 750 crore, if I remember correctly. Mm. So in India, historically, the scalability has been a big issue. And we know that, you know, investing returns are highly correlated with earnings per share of the company, right? Yeah. So if you are able to grow sales growth, you know, there is a high chance if we are doing it profitably, you can also grow your earnings. And if you can grow your earnings, you know, your investing returns will also be high, right? Yeah. And these are typical 175 companies, include the likes of Asian Paints, Pidilite, and those big companies which we see all around us, right? Reliance and all these companies. So one, you know, the scalability is big issue, and second is corporate governance, because the standards of accounting and the way of doing things in an informal economy is not that great. So if we see that from the lenses of fund manager, probably they are right that, you know, why to go beyond those 200, 300 names, where one, we don't have visibility in terms of scalability, and there are underlying reasons to that, right? We know how much time it takes to take clearances and environmental approvals and on the ground transport the goods and logistics and road infrastructure. So there are n number of reasons to it. But having said that, you know, if we think as a hat, wearing a hat of fund manager, probably they are right, you know, that if you just focus on 200, 300 names, there you have at least a steady return expectations, and yeah, you don't have risk of getting into a big trap where you lose all your money. So even if you get like 5, 7, 10% lesser returns, it's a safer haven. You know, there is a typical saying, right? Nobody gets fired to buy IBM in the fund management. So, you know, if they risk something down the line, even if it is good, but sometimes they might land up into bad companies and they might lose job, right? So that way, it's hard, and they are right in a way. Having said that, even in the mid-cap, small-cap space, we have seen that some companies can do phenomenally well if we are doing our ground research and actually applying those value investing principles. And again, how I do it is more of blending both, you know. So I definitely look at price action, where at least the hard work gets reduced, that okay, somebody smart is buying that, so probably something is happening there and there are growth triggers.
Yeah.
So probably you start looking there and then apply the framework of the broader margin of safety, ROE, ROC, and reinvestment of cash flows, and see whether that will materialize over a long period of time. And then incrementally we can scale up, right? So there is no point in putting like 5-10% of capital up front in these smaller names. We can average up the positions, and as the fundamental momentum picks up, as the company becomes better and better, we can increase the allocation.
Right. No, I mean, in terms of, you know, looking at things from a you know, philosophical manner, I think your entire philosophy of combining technicals with fundamentals, probably, you know, using one to do less amount of heavy lifting, shortlisting opportunities, and then using the another to actually go deep dive, that's definitely a very, I would say, practical and sensible way of kind of, you know, looking at the markets. And obviously, you know, applying those typical value levers, be it, I don't know, low leverage, be it cash flow generation, be it ROCE, that kind of, you know, is fairly interesting and actionable. My last question is, you know, like we keep on talking about technology, right? We keep on talking about technology from a business model perspective. But how about looking at technology from the perspective of investing itself? Like, are you kind of, what's your thought on, like, you know, looking at things like high frequency trading, you know, looking at purely technological tools to make investing decisions? Or do you think in a market like India where, you know, be it from a disclosure perspective, from a governance perspective, you have to get your hands dirty. Like, you actually have to do channel checks. You have to, you know, actually get, you know, have your ears close to the ground. Those technological tools probably are somewhere, you know, there's some more time to go before they can actually be applied at scale.
I think some of my friends are already doing, you know, they are into high frequency trading. Some are into AI based. They are still exploring. It's like AI is again a very big ocean of things. But they are exploring a lot of such automated things. You know, even I have one friend in analytics who is trying to apply analytics principle into investing, and he is finding some very good results. So I think it's again depending upon how best you are in using this. You know, I have seen examples or sample sizes where people have got good success in these niches and areas of investing. On the other hand, if we talk about more around technology aspects, around tools which are available in the Indian market, I think today's time and age, I think it's probably the best time for individual investors to get access to information at a very, very low cost. You know, today, if somebody wants a research report, it's like within 15 minutes of publication, you can get it probably free. You know, you get price and volume data almost, you know, real time. And we get financial statements and tools where we can see different ratios and underlying data almost real time. And now, you know, with COVID, probably the AGMs and the con calls are happening online, and you can get a recording of AGMs real time. So I would say as a retail investor, it's probably best time in terms of access to information. It's just that, you know, the difficulty lies in filtering and implementing these information, right? Because now there is probably overload of such information, and there are like almost 5,000 companies listed. So the question is, how do one start and what's the best way to use this information that is more relevant in these times?
I mean, you miss the most important tool, you know, WhatsApp. In India, if someone gets a paid equity research report, it probably will go on a WhatsApp podcast list. And the equity research as a business model has no chance here. But no, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, this is probably the best time to get data, and it's more about what you make out of it. No, this was a very interesting and fascinating chat, Vivek. And obviously, you know, we wish you, you know, all the best on your future trajectory of being even more stronger proponent of financial freedom and value investing. And obviously, it's always good to, you know, pick your brain on these things. And I think that's about it, Sharad.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was a fun chat. I'm going to go back to the to my portfolio and see what other investments I can pick up and use some fundamental
and
technical
analysis. Thank you very much. And again, would like to just reiterate that everything we talked was just my personal view, stock recommendation, and everything was for educational purpose only.
Yeah, man, we didn't recommend anything, unfortunately. Anyways, but that's how things should be. And no, thanks a lot, Vivek. And with that, I think we can call it an end. This was fun, and this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran
signing off. Yeah.